From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
I made it very clear to the president that I recognize the United States has a responsibility in the fight against drugs.
Under the plan, America will provide training programs and military equipment. Undoubtedly, in terms of influence, it will also tie Mexico closer to Washington.
Plan Mexico. President Bush signs a multi-million dollar agreement between Mexico and the United States to fight drug trafficking. We'll take an in-depth look at the deal and its effects on both countries. But first, talks to expand the World Trade Organization have collapsed after a week of negotiations. All that and more coming up. This is Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Democracy Now! Producer Sherif Abdul-Quddus with Anjali Kamat. It's our privilege to be joining you on the show for these next 2 days. Amy Goodman will be back on Monday. Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert announced his resignation Wednesday, months after becoming the target of two corruption investigations. Olmert will remain Prime Minister until September 17th, when his Kadima party will hold an election to choose a new leader. Palestinian legislator Mustafa Barghouti predicted Olmert's resignation will mark the end of the Annapolis peace talks.
He shot Annapolis yesterday when he declared that there is no possibility of reaching an agreement by the end of the year. He destroyed Annapolis by declaring that Jerusalem is not part of the discussion. And today, by this resignation, probably he's providing the ammunition to kill, finally, the Annapolis process completely. Olmert is finishing with failures. But his biggest failure is that he has proven that up till now there is no partner for peace in Israel.
Ehud Olmert has repeatedly denied any wrongdoing in connection to the corruption claims that he received cash-stuffed envelopes from a U.S. businessman. The House Judiciary Committee has voted to recommend that Karl Rove be held in contempt of Congress for defying a subpoena to testify about how the White House helped politicize the Justice Department. The committee vote is only a recommendation. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi said she would not decide until September whether to bring a contempt citation to a full House vote. Turkey's highest court has struck down an attempt to outlaw the country's ruling AK party and ban many of its members, including Turkey's prime minister and president. For years, the Turkish military has accused the Islamic-rooted AKP of undermining Turkey's secular laws. Six of the 11 judges on the Turkish court favored banning the AKP, one vote short of the seven required. Instead, the court sanctioned the AKP by cutting off state funding for the party. The chair of the Turkish Constitutional Court, Hasim Kilic, said the ruling should be seen as a strong warning for the AKP.
AK Parti'nin kapatılmasıyla ilgili açılan davanın sonucunda...
It is decided to not ban the party. The court decided to impose partial financial penalties. The party will not be banned, but everybody should evaluate the decision very carefully. The decision should be accepted as a very strong warning for AKP. Six court members voted yes, four members voted for imposing financial penalties, and one person voted for rejection of the case.
Supporters of the AK party accused the military and the court of trying to stage a judicial coup. A major study prepared for the Pentagon has criticized how the Bush administration has focused on using military might to defeat al-Qaeda in the so-called war on terror. The RAND Corporation study concludes that the current strategy for defeating al-Qaeda has failed in diminishing the group's capabilities. The study recommends a fundamental rethinking of U.S. strategy to focus on minimizing overt military action while increasing intelligence collection and partnerships with law enforcement agencies around the world. The co-author of the study, Seth Jones, said, quote, "Terrorists should be perceived and described as criminals, not holy warriors, and our analysis suggests there is no battlefield solution to terrorism." The International Olympic Committee has acknowledged that foreign journalists in Beijing will be blocked from accessing websites critical of the Chinese government during the Olympic Games. Banned sites include Amnesty International, Reporters Without Borders, and the BBC's Chinese language site. A Beijing Olympic spokesperson defended the censorship.
Similar to practices in other countries, China is acting in accordance with its laws with regards to control of the Internet. According to Chinese law, the Internet cannot be used to transmit information that is illegal, such as promoting the evil cult Falun Gong or threatening national security. So we hope that the media will respect Chinese laws and regulations.
Reporters Without Borders has issued a guide on how journalists can use proxy servers to get around China's censorship. Meanwhile, the Chinese government has sent a 50-year-old school worker to a labor camp for a year for posting photographs online of schools that collapsed during the May earthquake. Former Bosnian Serb leader Radovan Karadzic has been taken into custody by the UN War Crimes Tribunal to face trial at The Hague on charges of genocide. He's due to appear in court today. Serbian journalist Aleksandar Vasović praised Serbia for extraditing Karadzic.
This is a major step towards Serbia's place in Europe where the country belongs. Serbia now must face, through this trial and through every next trial, perhaps of General Ratko Mladic soon, to face everything that was done and undertaken in the name of the people of Serbia, including crimes, atrocities and everything else.
Radovan Karadzic was arrested in Belgrade last week after 13 years on the run. Karadzic has said that he does not recognize the UN War Crimes Tribunal and plans to conduct his own defense. Ecuador has formally told the Bush administration the U.S. military must vacate the base in the Ecuadorian city of Manta once its lease expires next year. The U.S. has used the Manta base for the past decade to lead anti-drug fights throughout Latin America. Ecuador's ambassador to the United States, Luis Gallegos, said, quote, "The Ecuadorian people do not want foreign troops on our soil, and the government has to follow the mandate of its people." Meanwhile, Newsweek reports Chevron is urging the Bush administration to yank special trade preferences for Ecuador if the country's government doesn't quash a lawsuit against the oil company. Chevron has been sued for dumping billions of gallons of toxic oil waste into Ecuador's rainforest. Activists have described the disaster as an Amazon Chernobyl. Earlier this year, a court-appointed expert recommended Chevron be required to pay up to $16 billion to clean up the rainforest. Now Chevron is lobbying the Bush administration to pressure Ecuador to quash the case. Chevron's lobbying team includes former Senate Majority Leader Trent Lott, former Democratic Senator John Breaux, and Wayne Berman, a top fundraiser for John McCain. One lobbyist told Newsweek, quote, "We can't let little countries screw around with big companies like this, companies that have made big investments around the world." Two boats carrying humanitarian activists are preparing to set sail this week from Cyprus and head to the Gaza Strip in a bid to break Israel's blockade and raise awareness for Palestinian human rights. Paul Larudi of the Free Gaza Movement spoke in Athens on Tuesday.
The mission is to enter Gaza without passing through the territory of Israel or Egypt, going from international waters directly into Gaza. It hasn't been done since 1967. And there's reason to think that no one will interfere with us if we go, because Israel has said that they no longer occupy Gaza, so we want to put it to the test.
Federal and state law enforcement officials in Colorado plan to increase intelligence operations during the Democratic National Convention in Denver and run a fusion center where intelligence analysts will collect and analyze reports of suspicious activity. The Colorado Independent reports the military will also be sharing intelligence information and providing support throughout U.S. Northern Command, a unit stationed at Peterson Air Force Base in Colorado Springs that was created in 2002 for Homeland Defense. Civil rights advocates fear the fusion center could enable unwarranted spying on protesters exercising their First Amendment rights at the convention. And Mother Jones magazine has revealed a well-known activist in the gun control movement is actually a secret spy for the National Rifle Association and the gun lobby. Over the past decade, the woman, Mary Lou Sapone, managed to become active in almost every single major gun violence prevention organization. Sapone, who went by her maiden name, Mary McFate, helped organize the Million Mom March in 2000 and oversaw the lobbying efforts of States United to Prevent Gun Violence. Mother Jones reports Sapone has a history of spying on activists. During the 1980s, Sapone infiltrated the animal rights community while working as an operative for a Connecticut-based security firm. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Sherif Abdul-Quddus with Anjali Kamat.
And welcome to all of our listeners and viewers around the country and across the world. Talks to expand the World Trade Organization have collapsed after a week of negotiations. The United States and other industrial nations have been trying to expand the WTO since 2001, after a trade meeting in Doha. WTO Chair Pascal Lamy announced the talks' failure.
I think it's no use beating around the bush, this meeting has collapsed.
The talks broke down in part because India and other developing nations demanded the right to protect their farming sectors against heavily subsidized imports. The U.S. refused to accept the protections and insisted on giving U.S. corporations greater access to markets in India, China, and other nations. Raj Patel is a writer and activist who's seen both sides of the corporate globalization debate firsthand. He's worked for the WTO, the World Bank, and the United Nations, and has also protested them on four continents. Currently, he's a visiting scholar at the Center for African Studies at the University of California at Berkeley. He's also the author of the book Stuffed and Starved, The Hidden Battle for the World Food System, which came out in April. Raj Patel joins us on the line from San Francisco. Raj, welcome to Democracy Now!
Good morning, Anjali.
Good morning. Raj Patel, tell us, why did the WTO talks collapse, and does it matter?
Well, the talks collapsed because India and China, but mainly India, demanded certain kinds of protections for its farmers if it was going to liberalize agricultural trade. And the United States, Europe, and Australia, and a group of other countries were not ready to concede any further on those kinds of demands. Europe and the United States had felt that they'd made enough concessions to India by allowing more visas for technically qualified personnel to come and work in the U.S. and in Europe. And they felt that those concessions showed willing in certain areas of the negotiations. But India is in an election year right now. And traditionally, at the time of Indian elections, Indian politicians have to act a little bit more democratic. So while normally they're ready to sell down their rural population and to sell their rural population down the river and to agree to policies that imperil the food security of people in rural areas, during an election year, that all flips around. And the Indian government has made commitments to fight farmers' debt, for example, this year, and they couldn't very well make big concessions around agriculture at the World Trade Organization, particularly because they're on the brink of an election cycle. So India was emboldened to take a fairly aggressive position in the negotiations around agriculture. The U.S. And a group of other countries were feeling fairly aggressive about the amount that they'd already given. There was dissension within the ranks in Europe, and essentially it had all the recipes to the makings of a disaster, and in fact that's what it turned out to be. Now, but you asked also, does it matter? Well, bear in mind, this is the third time in 3 years that this has happened. And the substance of the disagreement wasn't really around should there be a World Trade Organization or not. The parties around the table seem all fairly committed to multilateralism, to this kind of neoliberal economic policy. No one around the table said, no, actually, you know what, we're heading towards a whole new, different way of developing our economies. No one said that. And that suggests to me, rather sadly, that what will happen after the Indian election or after the United States election is that these parties will get back around the table again and carry on pushing forward their economic agenda. And, of course, the tragedy is that in the meantime, we're stuck with the inequities of the World Trade Organization policies that have been on the books since 1995. And those policies prevent developing countries from supporting their farmers, prevent developing countries from investing in their industries, and allow corporations, whether in developing or developed worlds, large corporations, access to each other's markets while penalizing the poorer citizens, either in agriculture in developing countries or in manufacturing in developed countries.
Raj Patel, can you explain exactly what are the special safeguard mechanisms that were the crux of the disagreement between India and the United States?
Okay, so when you have the liberalization of any commodity, the price of that commodity to domestic consumers will go down. And all of a sudden, you have the danger of what are called import surges. Just to give an example of what an import surge looks like, in Ghana, for example, before a recent trade liberalization, the level of domestic rice production was around 60%. And after the liberalization, the amount of rice produced domestically was only 20%. In other words, a large segment, the majority of domestic rice producers in Ghana were wiped out by a surge of rice coming, in this particular case, from subsidized by the United States. So what India wanted to do was to protect its farmers from that sort of a surge. And the special safeguard mechanism was the way in which that surge would be countered. It was essentially a threshold beyond which India has the right to impose import tariffs. And India walked away from the table because that threshold was so high it was meaningless.
Raj Patel, I wanted to ask you about the aims of the developing countries in the WTO talks. Shortly before the talks collapsed, Indian Trade Minister Kamal Nath claimed his chief goal was to protect Indian farmers.
Well, I mean, as I say, in an election year, he would be foolish not to say that. But if you look at the way that the Indian government has been systematically reducing the amount of expenditure that has been given to rural development over the past 20 years, you've got to wonder about the depth of the Indian government's commitment to its poorest people, to the people who live and work in rural areas, and particularly, therefore, to women in rural India. But I think this is a bit of a charade. But it's also important to remember that the developing countries aren't of the same mind. India was very keen to protect its farmers in this particular round or in this particular set of talks. But Brazil, for example, was very keen and very aggressive about promoting agricultural liberalization because the Brazilian government represents the interests of huge agricultural exporting interests, not small family farmers there, but vast agricultural conglomerations that look very much like the American agricultural conglomerations. And so Brazil's position was that they wanted a lot of liberalization. India, on the other hand, wanted very little in agriculture. So, I mean, there's a certain amount of disunity within developing countries, depending on what their exporting strengths are.
And the impact, Raj Patel, of China joining the WTO in 2001, when China joined, there was a certain amount of excitement about, more countries from the global south joining the WTO.
Yes, I mean, I had friends who were committed third worldists who remember the non-aligned movement and hoped that China would bring a certain measure of socialism with Chinese characteristics into the World Trade Organization. And sadly, what China brought in was capitalism with Chinese characteristics. So while there was a lot of hope that China would bring a certain kind of solidarity with the oppressed people of the Third World, that sadly was a political fantasy that long ago expired. And instead, what China has brought in is a hard-nosed negotiation position that is like every developing country is primed towards the interests of its most powerful citizens rather than its least powerful.
Raj Patel, what are the prospects for a change in U.S. trade policy with a new administration? I mean, this is an election year. You've had Barack Obama being very critical of free trade and NAFTA in particular on the campaign trail and then seeming to back off that somewhat. What's your sense of that?
Well, I think the same as applies to India kind of applies to the United States right now. It is an election year. You're absolutely right, Sharif. And the consequences of that are that there's going to be a certain amount of posturing around the sort of crocodile tears that you hear from rich people about the plight of poor people, and particularly in the United States, the understanding that trade has cost jobs for blue-collar workers here. And trade has imperiled the ability of blue-collar workers to unionize even. That is certainly sort of one of the stories that's circulating in the political rhetoric. But I doubt, I mean, I question the depth of the commitment of Barack Obama to addressing the deep problems that, are associated with the current international trade regime. I haven't heard him say that, he's going to tear up the World Trade Organization charter and try to negotiate something else. And far from it. He's never gone anywhere close to saying that. All he said is that he would like NAFTA to be renegotiated with stronger environmental and labor provisions. And, of course, that was the promise that Clinton made to be able to get NAFTA through in the first place. And those environmental and labor provisions have been worse than toilet paper. So I unfortunately am very – I have my expectations set very low for the next administration.
Raj Patel, you spent a little time interning at the World Trade Organization. Can you talk about that experience?
Yeah, well, I was curious to see how it all worked, and I volunteered and I was accepted to be an intern in the Economic Research Department. And I was tasked with finding out why it was, or what the link was between trade and the environment. Does more trade harm the environment or not? And I did the research as best as I was able, and I reviewed a great deal of economic literature, the cutting edge of economic literature at the time, which showed that actually, yes, increased trade does damage the environment. And not just because there's more stuff being produced and it's being sent backwards and forwards, but because the way that international trade works is that it offshores as much production as it can to areas with low environmental standards, and therefore the amount of pollution produced per unit of whatever it is greater in the place where it ends up. So the conclusion was fairly straightforwardly that yes, trade does increase environmental damage, and my superiors at the World Trade Organization took my draft report and rewrote it to come up with the opposite conclusion. So I am very skeptical now when the WTO purports to offer unbiased conclusions about what the so-called benefits of its operations to the international economy, because I guess I've seen firsthand how people's perspectives rather depend on a very politicized understanding of how to represent the facts around the global economy.
Raj Patel, your book is Stuffed and Starved, The Hidden Battle for the World Food System, and I'd like to go back to the global food crisis and its connection to free trade policies. What countries have been affected most by the global food crisis?
The shorthand for understanding the countries that have been hit hardest is to look both at the level of wages in those countries and to see the extent to which they are reliant on imports to be able to meet their needs. One of the most disturbing examples is Haiti, which is the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere, and which has been forced by successive U.S. governments to embrace the ideals of international trade. Even before the World Trade Organization was founded, Haiti was being forced to adopt its policies. And Haiti actually stands for a number of other countries in the Western Hemisphere, in sub-Saharan Africa, in Asia, that have been forced to liberalize their economies and are now hostage to the international price rises. And in Haiti, the consequences were that the government was not allowed to support its rice producers. It wasn't allowed to invest in agriculture. So in the 1980s, Haiti produced the majority of its own rice, and now in Haiti, the almost all the rice comes from the United States. And that's the sort of singular consequence of the intersection between free trade and so-called free trade and development policy in developing countries.
Finally, Raj Patel, do you hold out any hope for efforts at reforming the WTO from within? And also, you know, you've talked about the inequities in global trade policy and the structure of the WTO. What do you see as any sort of hope for the future, either within the WTO or without?
I don't see a whole lot of hope within the WTO. I mean, bear in mind that the WTO is basically a club of powerful states that make other states do what they're told. In fact, that was one of the remarks of the U.S. trade representative Susan Schwab, that India and China were failing to get into the spirit of the talks. And historically, the spirit of the talks has been for India and China and all the other developing countries to shut up and do what the United States and Europe tell them to do. Now, what has changed is just that China and India and a few other developing countries are here to stay, and Europe and the United States need to learn to change their negotiating positions in order to be able to get the agreements they want. But there's no impetus within the WTO to be able to make serious substantive changes. But what I do see as hopeful is the kinds of alternatives that are being proposed by international groups such as Via Campesina, one of the world's largest social movements that has, by some estimates, 150 million people in it. And they've got a vision of exchange, of agricultural policy, of empowerment, particularly women's empowerment, that's known as food sovereignty. And this is something that Via Campesina member movements are fighting for wherever they are. In the United States, it's the National Family Farm Coalition. But in India, there are half a dozen movements. In Brazil, it's the Brazilian Landless Rural Workers Movement. All of these movements, but large mass-based democratic movements, are pushing their governments to adopt the policies that would invest in rural agriculture, that are not tilted towards the big corporations, but are tilted towards sustainability. And as the current food crisis gets worse, I think that there's a stronger and stronger case for the alternative that the global justice movement is offering, and I think that's very hopeful.
Raj Patel, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Raj Patel is a writer and activist. His book is Stuffed and Starved, The Hidden Battle for the World Food System. We have to break, but when we come back, Plan Mexico. We'll take an in-depth look at the multi-million dollar agreement between Mexico and the United States. Stay with us. Testify by Rage Against the Machine here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Sharif Abdul-Quddus with Angelique Comet.
As the WTO talks collapse, we turn now to the country perhaps most profoundly impacted by U.S. trade during the neoliberal era. In the 15th year since the North American Free Trade Agreement was signed, Mexico continues to fall short of the lofty gains that backers of the neoliberal globalization had promised. Today, polls show that by a 2-to-1 margin, Mexicans believe they're on the losing end of NAFTA. The latest U.S. initiative in Mexico is also attracting scrutiny. Last month, the Bush administration and the Democratic-led Congress agreed on Plan Mexico, a $400 million program to fight Mexican drug trafficking. Much like its predecessor, Plan Colombia, the Mexico initiative has been criticized for emphasizing militarization and security rather than addressing social and economic causes. The bulk of the money will go to military contractors and Mexico's armed forces. The final version of the bill also omits several key provisions that would have linked funding to human rights. In a few moments, we'll talk to three guests about Plan Mexico. But first, we turn to an excerpt from last week's episode of Inside USA, an investigative news program airing on the network Al Jazeera English.
Culiacán, Mexico. This is a city on the front line of war, one that is at its heart deeply tied to policies made in Washington. Since Mexican President Felipe Calderón came to power, more than 4,000 have been murdered in drug trafficking-related crimes, many times more than the number of U.S. soldiers killed in Iraq and Afghanistan in the same time period. At stake, control of tens of billions of dollars of cocaine and methamphetamines flowing annually to American drug users. It's not just the traffickers who are being killed. Dozens of civilians have been caught up in the crossfire, journalists assassinated, and hundreds of Mexican security forces gunned down. In this Culiacán cemetery, the family of one policeman recently killed bury his body. He's being laid to rest in a modest grave next to the extravagant mausoleums built for slain drug traffickers.
It's always tough when you lose one of your men.
For Police Commander Manuel Hernandez, seeing his men fall has become a regular occurrence, and the fear of being killed is beginning to take its toll.
Of course I'm scared. I'm a human being. And I would be scared, or otherwise I would be crazy. But I'm more scared of not doing my duty for Mexico, out of fear for my life.
His officer's death is not expected to be the last. Dozens of graves here are being dug to accommodate the growing casualties. The violence in Sinaloa, home to some of the largest drug cartels in Mexico, is taking place on a massive scale. The capital, Culiacán, averages 4 executions a day. We followed local journalists and police on what has become a grisly daily ritual. On the streets, it seems that the huge number of security forces are completely powerless to stem the violence. Bodies are discovered almost on the hour in all parts of the city. As night falls on day 2 of our tour of this region, 3 more young men have been gunned down here on the streets of Culiacán. Bodies 7, 8, and 9 in less than 48 hours. And the violence is terrifying in its brutality. Recently, in a chilling message from the cartels, 9 bodies were decapitated, the heads dumped in the center of the city for police to collect. Often in response to the violence, police are accused of spraying quiet streets with bullets, with little regard for civilian life.
This is the bullet hole from the police that happened on Friday morning.
The residents here keep tallies on each day's escalating body count by reading what's referred to as the execution meter on the front page of one local newspaper. Mexican President Felipe Calderón, more than a year and a half ago, declared war on the cartels. 25,000 troops and police flooded into a number of cities. Also wading into the fight, the United States of America. Approximately $1.5 billion of direct military aid was pledged by President Bush. Called the Mérida Initiative, or Plan Mexico, the move follows a similar blueprint to the widely criticized and ultimately failed Plan Colombia.
I made it very clear to the president that I recognize the United States has a responsibility in the fight against drugs.
Under the plan, America will provide training programs and military equipment. Undoubtedly, in terms of influence, it will also tie Mexico closer to Washington. In fact, just one day after the plan was signed into law by George Bush, serious questions were raised about exactly what sort of training the U.S. would provide. Shocking videos surfaced showing Mexican police undergoing a torture training session directed by a contractor believed to be working for a U.S. private security firm. In one video, the contractor drags an officer through his own vomit. In another, a victim receives shots of water up his nose, a common torture technique.
That they were training people to torture. The guards torturing, the police torturing.
Mercedes Murillo is one of Mexico's most vocal human rights activists. She believes corrupt police forces in Mexico are responsible for a number of murders and also involved in the drug trade itself, and that U.S. money and training will only make the situation worse.
In this we have in the States, some policemen are good, and some, of course, are bad. But the good ones, I'm afraid that these people are going to make all our police bad.
Regardless of who is killing who, there is no doubt that one of the biggest problems here is the staggering number of weapons on the streets. High-powered assault rifles and machine guns are easy to come by, despite strict gun laws here. On this street, we witnessed the body of one uniformed police officer shot dead on his way to work. The chances are that the bullets that riddled his car were fired from a U.S. gun. According to some sources, 2,000 illegal firearms are brought into Mexico every day from the United States.
The fact that the U.S. Constitution allows any person to freely buy, without any limitations, high-caliber weapons has made Mexico full of guns that fundamentally originated in the United States. And with their sophistication and firepower, they are much stronger than the military and police forces here.
So in a game of supply and demand, the drugs flow into America, U.S. guns flow into Mexico. It's a business known by all.
The same as you go and buy a hamburger, you can go and buy a gun. It's the same.
In America.
In America. All America.
One such weapon was traced to this Texas gun shop just across the border from Ciudad Juarez. Kalashnikovs sold here, like this one, made in Las Vegas, Nevada, are now easier to buy after the Bush administration in 2004 failed to renew a ban on assault weapons and are now pouring into Mexico.
As long as the people over there are willing to pay $5,000 for a gun that you can buy for $600 over here, somebody's going to try to sneak one across the border.
Oh, it's anywhere you want to cross.
The federal government, according to Texas Sheriff Arvin West, has done little to stop the flood of weapons into Mexico.
We've seen as many as 13 semi-trucks going into Mexico, and the federal government just non-complacent about it. They could care less. It's simple. I mean, we've got 90 miles, or a little over 90 miles of border, right at 100 miles, actually, of border in this county that's wide open.
On the Mexican side of the border, we watched several vehicles roll through with no more than a passing glance from customs officials here. Throughout Mexico, American guns continue to kill. Just weeks ago in the small town of El Poso, 13 people were murdered, one of them a 14-year-old boy. The evidence of what happened here we found littered across the ground.
They're afraid that people will come and that when they find them, they'll shoot them.
Like refugees in a war zone, many residents are now packing up to leave. They believe the worst is yet to come. Critics say that Plan Mexico is following a tried and failed U.S. policy on drugs. As long as Washington continues to focus on cutting the supply to the U.S. rather than treating the drug problem from within, questions must be asked about its complicity in the escalating violence seen across the border. For those on the streets, the war goes on, fueled by America's guns on both sides.
So they mix security with fear. They mix security with politics. And they mix security with lies.
What Mexico needs to do is enforce the laws that they've got. Start putting some of these bad guys in jail.
We have more people dead right now that in Iraq.
I guarantee our guys will go down there and, for lack of better words, will kick ass and take names.
Because it's the same. It's a war.
An excerpt of the program Inside USA. We're joined now by three guests. Avi Lewis is the host of Inside USA, airing weekly on Al Jazeera English. He's also a filmmaker. Along with Naomi Klein, he made the 2004 documentary The Take about Argentina's recovered factory movement. Avi Lewis joins us now from Washington, D.C. Laura Carlson is also with us. She's the director of the Mexico City-based America's Policy Program for the Center for International Policy. She has written extensively on U.S.-Mexico relations and blogs at the website americasmexico.blogspot.com. Laura Carlson joins us from Portland, Oregon. And on the line from Mexico, we're joined by John Gibler. He's an independent journalist and Global Exchange Human Rights Fellow based in Mexico. His forthcoming book is called Mexico Unconquered, Chronicles of Power and Revolt. John Gibler is speaking to us from Tapachula near Mexico's southern border with Guatemala. We welcome you all to Democracy Now! Avi Lewis, I want to start with you. You just got back from Mexico. Can you talk about the sense that people have in Mexico of American culpability for the human toll of the war on drugs?
Well, I mean, the images are, of course, dramatic and staggering, and the death toll is shocking. But for me, what this story does is it just recasts the whole conversation about the border. In Mexico, people would be very, very grateful to have a kind of discourse about securing the border the way we have here in the United States. There's a desperate need to secure the border because American guns are pouring over the border, and there's a direct human toll. But it's also—this is a movie we've seen before. And Plan Colombia is in the background of this whole conversation, because under the sort of, you know, under the story of a war on drugs, if you look at the details of Plan Mexico, $400 million in the first year, more than half of it is going to hardware that both eight Bell helicopters with night vision equipment that track people back and forth across the border as easy as drugs, and a huge IT system for the Mexican Migration Institute, which has its explicit goal to track the movement of Mexican citizens and Central Americans coming through Mexico. So you have this kind of biometric immigration agenda, which is being swept in under cover of a war on drugs rhetoric. And when there's this much bloodshed in the streets in Mexico, it's very easy for the blood to hide the political agendas underneath.
Laura Carlson, you're the director of the America's Policy Program of the Center for International Policy based in Mexico City. You've written extensively about Plan Mexico, and you related its origins back to NAFTA. Could you talk about that?
Well, in March of 2005, NAFTA was extended into the Security and Prosperity Partnership. And this was an unprecedented move for a trade agreement to go into the security area. But it's something that the Bush administration had been wanting to do for a long time. Essentially, the idea was to push the borders out of the United States and create a North American security perimeter that would include Canada and Mexico. In this way, the Bush government, what it sought to do was to apply the radical national security doctrine to Mexican territory as well. This is a big problem for Mexico because it not only violates national sovereignty, but it also imposes on Mexico the security priorities of the United States government at a time when those are very belligerent and aggressive priorities throughout the world. In the case of Plan Mexico, it's a perfect example of the result of those policies. Essentially, it's very important what Avi says, that it's not just a counter-narcotics program. It's a regional cooperation security initiative that includes counter-narcotics, counter-terrorism, and border security. So it lumps these together and basically gets a greater military presence for the United States within Mexico, not actual troops, but in terms of its intervention in the Mexican national security apparatus, and imposes the agenda of the United States government on that country.
Sorry, just to jump in, there's a fellow named Thomas Shannon, who's a senior State Department official. a senior State Department official named Thomas Shannon, who's deeply involved in the Security and Prosperity Partnership, I think kind of let the cat out of the bag in a speech this past spring when he was talking about the SPP and North America as a shared economic space, which is the current lingo for this worldview. And he said explicitly, what we're doing in some way, in a certain respect, is armoring NAFTA. And I think when you look at the intersection of the economic agenda, the cover of the war on drugs, the immigration and border hysteria underneath it, Plan Mexico represents exactly that, the armoring of NAFTA. And of course, it's not talked about in those ways when it's approved by Congress, when Democrats and Republicans reach across the aisle to support it.
Laura Carlson,
I think that's correct.
Go ahead.
I was going to say that it's no coincidence that this is coming up right at the time in which Mexico's involved in another very important debate, which relates to the privatization of the oil company. By having a militarized society, you are assuring a certain amount of social control. We know in Mexico that there will be mass opposition to the privatization of oil, and yet access to Mexico's oil resources has been another major objective of the SPP, the Security and Prosperity Partnership under NAFTA. So by having the army in the streets, you're in a position to quell social uprisings that may be coming up that have to do with control over natural resources as well.
Laura Carlson, I wanted to ask you to break down Plan Mexico for us. Where is the money going? What is it going into? And what are these human rights conditions that were supposed to be in it? How effective would they have been?
There is $116 million going directly to the Army in what they call military-to-military support. There's another major chunk, and some of these figures will have to wait until the Secretary of State submits its spending report to Congress, because they were changed in the long process of getting it approved within Congress. But the other huge chunk goes to the security forces, to the police on all levels within Mexico. There's another part called institution building, and there are some groups that have stated that this is supposedly the good part of the bill because it has to do with human rights training and development of the judicial systems, both of which are big needs within Mexico. However, there are a lot of suspicions among the Mexican people that this will not be an effective part of the package because, first of all, the United States government has little moral authority to carry out human rights training with Abu Ghraib, with the situation in Guantanamo, as well as a government that formally justifies torture. There's a lot of suspicion about how it's going to come into Mexico and do that kind of training. Another aspect is that much of the money will go to private security firms. We recently had the case of the torture tapes that were mentioned, where a private security firm that has an office in the United States was involved in training Mexican police forces precisely in torture. The conditions that were placed originally on this packet were rejected by the Mexican government as a violation of national sovereignty. They included a vetting of police forces and the approval by the State Department that that Mexico was indeed following its laws. They were in the end weakened after the Mexican government rejected them, and the final conditions have basically no impact whatsoever on the way that this money is applied. The State Department is allowed to withhold up to 15%, which is somewhat absurd, if it's found that Mexico is not applying its laws in regard to how this money should be spent and how security forces are operating. There's a stricture that they must maintain the prohibition on torture as a way of getting testimony. I just recently returned from a human rights delegation in which we were in Chiapas, Oaxaca, and Atenco, and we saw numerous cases where torture is routinely used to get confessions, and as long as it can be done with impunity, which it can be, it will be continued to be used. So I don't think these human rights conditions will have any impact whatsoever, and the overall impact of the plan will be negative in militarizing the society, as well as empowering military and police forces who are the worst violators of human rights within the country.
Well, we have to break for 60 seconds. When we come back, we'll continue this discussion. We're talking with Laura Carlson. She's the director of the Mexico City-based America's Policy Program of the Center for International Policy. Avi Lewis is in Washington, D.C. He's the host of Inside USA on Al Jazeera English. And when we come back, we'll also bring in John Gibler on the phone from Mexico. Stay with us.
suspires mi corazón, ni llores tu mala suerte. El pájaro que voló no es el pájaro que te divierte. No suspires mi corazón, ni llores tu mala suerte. El pájaro que voló no es el pájaro que te divierte.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Sherif Abdul-Quddus with Anjali Kamat. We're talking about Plan Mexico. We want to turn now to John Gibler. He joins us on the line from Mexico. He's an independent journalist and global exchange human rights fellow based in Mexico. His forthcoming book is Mexico Unconquered, Chronicles of Power and Revolt. John Gibler, your most recent article is titled Mexico's Ghost Towns, The Other Side of the Immigration Debate. Can you talk about it, please?
Good morning. Yes, thank you. I think it's essential to understand the link between the so-called free trade regime embodied in NAFTA and migration. NAFTA's economic restructuring of Mexico's economy has forced millions of small farmers from the countryside, and in so doing, shattered local food production and shattered local economies, thus forcing people to move across the border looking for work. Analysts that I interviewed at the University of Zacatecas said to me, Mexico, under this new economic regime, is exporting the factory of migrants. Also, they said, Mexico is mortgaging its future with remittances, the money that migrants send back. And what they argue is taking place is that the United States, through NAFTA, is holding Mexico at bay as a kind of reserve army of workers for its own industrial restructuring. Thus, all the benefits and the luxuries absent in Mexico's own countryside are being built and constructed and elaborated inside the United States by migrant labor, largely Mexican.
Laura Carlson, I wanted to ask you a question. Can you talk about the impact of Plan Mexico on social movements in Mexico?
Yes, well, already with the Mexican army in the streets, which is something that began as soon as Felipe Calderón became president and will be reinforced through Plan Mexico, what we're seeing is attacks, basically, on social movements. Within Chiapas, this has been particularly seen in the Zapatista autonomous communities, where the army has gone in often with the pretense of looking for drug production, which they've not found, but they've used it to harass those communities in which major battles over natural resources and their right to autonomy have been taking place. So indigenous peoples are one group that is at risk. Another, and this is cases that we've seen in the northern state of Chihuahua, has to do with opposition leaders in general. When Operation Chihuahua started, which is one of the major operations of the drug war, the army came in and they immediately rounded up several social leaders that had warrants out for their arrest since 2003 for blocking an international bridge in a protest over NAFTA. They were just routinely rounded up as part of these drug war operations. This is another group that we're going to be looking very carefully at because we believe that this will be happening in a widespread way throughout the country as the drug war is expanded. Other groups that are at risk include women, where the military has been responsible for a number of rapes and sexual abuse against women in different parts of the country, and also the opposition leaders and indigenous people and migrants that were mentioned before, who have become a criminal group under this particular model of a drug war and a fight against organized crime.
Well, Laura Carlson, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Laura Carlson is director of the Mexico City-based America's Policy Program of the Center for International Policy. Her report, A Primer on Plan Mexico, we'll link to that on our website at democracynow.org. And John Gibler joining us on the line from Mexico. He's an independent journalist and global exchange human rights fellow based in Mexico. His forthcoming book is Mexico Unconquered, Chronicles of Power and Revolt. Avi Lewis, I want you to stay with us. Avi Lewis is the host of Inside USA, airing weekly on Al Jazeera English. You won't find it almost anywhere in the United States. Despite a well-publicized launch nearly 2 years ago, Al Jazeera English is only available in three U.S. markets, Burlington, Vermont, Toledo, Ohio, and Washington, D.C. Avi Lewis, there was a startling story in the New York Daily News on Monday about a producer of Al Jazeera English trying to book an interview with an Iraq War veteran who was running for a seat in Congress, retired Army Lieutenant Colonel Alan West. Can you talk about what happened?
Well, Keith Olbermann called him out as the worst person in the world the other night, and it's kind of a funny story, and at the same time is shocking. I think there's a thread of in this show today of things that people do in election years, what they can get away with, and what's really going on under the surface. Lieutenant Colonel Alan West is running as a Republican in Florida in a congressional district around Boca Raton. He's a 22-year Army veteran. He served in both Iraq and Afghanistan. And one of our guest bookers was trying to reach him to get him on air during the news hour to interview him about rise in casualties and how the war in Afghanistan is going. She was pre-interviewing him, and you pre-interview a number of guests to try to find the right person for the show. And in a courtesy move, which is standard in television, she offered to send a car to pick him up and take him to the satellite studio where he'd do his interview. And when he heard this, he decided to call the FBI and claim that the Al Jazeera was trying to kidnap him, which is hilarious on one level and on another level. And he's making the most of it in his congressional race where he's an underdog and he's trying to beat up on Al Jazeera. I will never participate in a television network which is an enemy of our troops, et cetera. So it's sort of standard election year hyperbole and cartoonish politics. But working at Al Jazeera this year has been a crash course for me in the casual and persistent anti-Arab racism that my colleagues, especially the Arab-American colleagues at Al Jazeera, have been facing for years. Al Jazeera English is a separate network launched 2 years ago. It's a global news network. We have an audience of 120 million worldwide. It's a very serious, sometimes a little too serious, news network doing journalism in English around the world with, access to 60 bureaus worldwide. Al Jazeera Arabic is a network that revolutionized information in the Arab-speaking world starting in the early 1990s, doing independent journalism throughout Arab-speaking countries and being thrown out, basically, of almost every country where Al Jazeera Arabic has done independent journalism as a key project of advancing democracy and having independent information in a part of the world where there isn't enough of it. So Al Jazeera Arabic has really got it from both sides. But in an election year in the United States, to have incidents like this is quite shocking. And when we find, when we're trying to book guests for Al Jazeera English, that the to be treated as a quasi-terrorist organization, which is shocking as a serious news organization, goes completely across the political spectrum. In fact, the State Department and the Pentagon are on Al Jazeera English almost daily because they watch us and know what we do and take us very seriously because of our global audience.
Avi, we have under a minute left, but I wanted to ask you briefly about what happened in Burlington, Vermont, with Al Jazeera being on TV there.
Well, I mean, Al Jazeera is in a very few markets, and you get these local backlashes based on fear and xenophobia. But in Burlington, Vermont, and wherever we've been able to develop an actual local viewership, there's tremendous response. So when the city council tried to yank Al Jazeera from the local cable system, there was a tremendous community response, and Al Jazeera is still on the air. And I think, when people get a chance to watch the channel, they see that it's a serious news channel, but that doesn't stop us from being smeared, as Arabs and Muslims are incessantly smeared in the United States. And I think in an election year, Democrats and the Obama campaign and others have to stand up and really denounce it, rather than really validating the smears by denying any connection to Islam as if it was a smear. I think that's a political a mistake, and it's sad to see.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there. Avi Lewis, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Avi Lewis is the host of Inside USA, a weekly program airing on Al Jazeera English. And that does it for today's program. If you'd like to get a copy of the show, you can visit our website at democracynow.org. I'm Sherif Abdul-Qudus with Anjali Kamat. We'll be joining you again tomorrow. See you then.